All right, so Jared and I and a couple other people actually discussed a little bit of the format of this. Nice. The guilty look there was great. Yeah.
Right around the corner.
Anyway, the format for this, I think, confused a couple of people. And I just wanted to go through this. I think, Jared, wasn't it? You and I were talking about it last week? Okay. And then a couple other people, too. It's a little different. The part that tends to confuse people a little bit is the follow-up section, which is at the end. Did any of you find that to be a little confusing or whatever? At Cameron, I think we talked about it too, right? Okay, so what you do is you give them the homework, and then for the most part, they're just doing that on their own. And then at the next session, you ask if they had any questions. You can fill in, you can spend time going over those questions for whatever duration of time you deem fitting for that. But it's mainly to get them doing homework. And then the video you watch is the preview for the next week's reading. Okay? So it's like a trailer, you know, for a movie. It's giving you the preview of coming attraction. And so that's generally what it's trying to do. This week it's sin, and it's going to elaborate on that. Yeah, Mike.
I'm hearing some of the people are wondering how in the world they're going to do that.
What do you mean? Like they don't have a TV?
How it's going to work in their particular home. And
people probably don't know how to do it.
Whatever.
Well, it's just a DVD.
Oh, is it?
But look, you'd almost... A little computer...
Am I being cruel by saying that, Joe?
So a little computer's not going to work. So I guess if somebody had a TV screen on the wall,
yeah,
it would work.
Anybody needs to borrow a TV...
What do you let it forget it?
Okay, so you have you don't like communication.
I mean, it could be.
I don't know, that's just what I was thinking.
You have to have the DVD and then the connection from the DVD to your TV.
Yeah.
So it's, but a lot of people may not have DVDs today.
What do they have?
They just got,
they're just streaming now?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Do any of you have an issue in that with that? With not having a DVD player? Because we'll figure something out.
I mean, DVD player for $20.
Yeah.
They can borrow a DVD player.
Joe has an extra DVD player. He'll hook you up.
He'll hook you up.
There's also another resource. All of these sessions are on YouTube.
Oh, really?
And people can go review them because in our situation, they have to do it on YouTube.
Okay. And it's the same video like you've... Okay.
In fact, there's a fantastic 2-hour one where he goes at it appealing to somebody who's just, it's made for an internet browser, a person that's just surfing looking for Christianity or questions.
Very good. So there you go.
Sessions are all on there.
But I think what you're talking about is just how do we get like our whole group to be in a place where they can all hear it and see it.
Yeah.
That's largely what you're talking about.
When we do the small group stuff.
Yeah, Dan?
I have two projectors. We have another one at the office. I mean, if somebody's in a situation that they can't figure it out, just ask for help.
Yeah. Of course, we want to facilitate that as much as we can. Audio-wise, you might have an issue there if you're just showing it on a computer, but you can hook a speaker up to it or something like that. But talk to me or Edwin or Tavis, and hopefully we'll be able to help you out. It sounds like a couple of guys have things they can help some people out with, too. It shouldn't be too bad. I think... A TV would probably be the easiest way, you know, with a DVD player, just hook it up. Kind of, that's what we would do in our group. It does change the room, because we usually meet in a particular room in our house, and it would change the room we'd have to meet in, but you might have to have them in the theater in the basement, right?
Theoretically, we could cram them into the theater room, but it would be a different deal.
Yeah, you do have to think about the setting, especially if you're having visitors and things like that. How are we going to make this work? Yeah, really, very much.
Well, actually, that's not how I heard about it.
Well, I don't know if they can all fit in our theater, so. Did you see that? I stumped Mike. He didn't have anywhere to go. I got to write that down. Yeah, Dave.
Well, is it really a necessity? Do you have to show the
video? No, you don't have to show the video.
Second, going through the material, it suggested that you get I never heard of it, Book of Mark. Just mark home.
Yeah.
Or a Bible. Is there such a thing as a book on Mark?
Yeah.
You can get those cheaper.
You can get those for, what were they again, Tev?
Like $1.50.
$1.50?
Can we get them cheaper if we buy them in bulk?
Yes.
Yeah. The problem that we found was that the copies that they're giving, this is NIV, are ESV.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the copies they're selling officially for this are ESV. And, you know, so make sure you read the other version a little bit.
If it's available by YouTube, you could just use it as a teaser. You know, Wednesday before your thing, send it out to the people that are
That's true.
In your group and say, hey, look at this before you come. So just be creative.
Good. Yeah. Hopefully,
creativity.
Just send somebody a link. Hey, we got Edwin. We got Dav. They'll help you out. You know, with that kind of thing. Yeah. Exactly. But hopefully, I'm conveying in this that this is not just a paint by numbers thing. It is here if you want to do that. If that's where you have kind of your home row, where you feel comfortable, feel free to do that. Of course. At the same time, there is obvious flexibility in that. I like the videos. I think they're useful. I think they're thought-provoking. I think you can jump from that, especially if it's younger people maybe who are used to getting everything that way. It might be easier. I don't know. But we're trusting you, of course, to make the right call on how these things are going to work and all that. Because like Mike's saying, there could be issues where you just can't, or times where you just can't. It might determine the size of your group too. So let's say Mike has people over, and instead of having a large group, this is just a neighbor, you know, or two, and it's just Mike and Virginia and these two neighbors, and you could do that around a computer, I think, and get away with it audio-wise and all. Yeah. Okay. All right, so hopefully, if the format's confusing to you as far as the follow-up and all that, talk to me, and hopefully I can help you sort it out. It shouldn't be too complicated, but it is a little bit different because the homework is in the last section and so on and so forth. So, okay, so turn to page 49 in your book, the white book, or peer at someone else's white book if you don't get one, if you're not in the cool club, the white book club. Kurt, did you not bring your book?
I delegated.
No, that's right. I forgot. Did you get the red book?
No, I don't have any books.
Who'd you delegate it out to?
John and Blankenship, who's not here at the moment. Ugh. Cordell, who's
Isn't
also
that
not here. So
convenient.
So delegation's failing.
Okay. So on page 49, we are told to have someone read Mark chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. Joe, would you be willing? Yeah. Yep. Mark chapter 2, verse 1 through 12. This is page, Kurt, and yours in the red book. It's page 21.
When he had come back to Capernaum several days after, it was heard that he was at home, and many gathered together so that there was no longer room, not even near the door, and he was speaking the word to them. And they came bringing to him a paralytic carried by four men. Being unable to get to him because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him, and when they had dug an opening, they let down the pallet on which the paralytic was lying. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." But some of the scribes were sitting there and reasoning in their hearts, "Why does this man speak this that way? He is blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" Immediately, Jesus, aware in his spirit that they were reasoning that way within themselves, said to them, "Why are you reasoning about these things in your hearts? Which is easier to say to the paralytic, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Get up and pick up your pallet and walk'? But so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralytic, "I say to you, get up, pick up your pallet, and go home." And he got up and immediately picked up the pallet and went out in the sight of everyone, so that they were all amazed and were glorifying God, saying, "You've never seen anything like this."
Now, I wanted Joe to read that whole thing for more than one reason. We're going to do a couple of the questions that they have for this, but also to say our 45 minutes in here goes really fast, and that's clearly not enough time if you're going to hit every question and if you're going to read every text, right? Which maybe you don't. Maybe you don't cover all these things. Like was mentioned with the video, maybe you don't show the video that week or something like that. But you need to consider the time constraints that you have within your group. Our group always has various little children. And so that makes things a little bit more like, okay, we need to move it along because Priscilla's sick and tired of being with the kids, that kind of thing. Or it's just they're getting rowdy or whatever. So you've got to be considerate of those issues. However, if you have the ability to expand it and to spend going through each question, do it, you know, by all means. Lois, how's it going so far for you at the group you're doing?
It's going good. We Skype.
Yeah.
So they're watching. We're going to try something a little different because our time is real limited. And
yeah.
With a nursing home situation, they're on a really tight schedule.
Yeah.
So we're Skyping from St. Joe's over to Montvale. Two ladies at St. Joe's are doing the study.
Right.
And we're going to...
Are you getting through all the questions and stuff, though, or are you abbreviating?
We're doing the homework.
Okay.
They want to spend time praying together because it's very important to them because they don't get out to church to connect
okay.
and support prayer team.
So that adds time, too,
yeah,
as far as together.
Yeah, and we have to get it in 1 hour.
Okay.
So
how much of the lesson do you get through of the times you've been through it so far?
They do the lesson, and they have found it online.
Okay.
Two of them can't write, so they have to do it online.
Okay, so you have... people that are interested in taking some level of initiative quite easily.
Interested.
Good.
In fact, they're moving ahead.
Good.
They're hungry and they're really interested because they have, these are potential leaders.
Right.
Because they have their own sphere of
influence and such.
Yeah.
So this is kind of an ideal case situation, you know, where you have some people that are interested that want to, and they're kind of doing it on their own here a bit. So then time constraints are not an issue, if you will, because they're going to make time somewhere during their week to make sure they get through it. That might not always go that way.
The hour that we meet is real important for them.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Because they're connecting and this is some fellowship for them.
Good. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that just reading through that text takes a few minutes, like Joe did there a second ago. And so these kind of, you've got to read ahead and make sure you know kind of what you're looking at. Don't just wing it on the time frame. Okay, so the first question here is, a huge crowd gathered to hear Jesus. Why? What kind of reputation had he built up during these early days of his ministry? That's an actual question.
He was doing miraculous things, healing people.
Good.
People wanted to be healed.
Right.
He was saying things that no one else was saying.
Right. So he's doing miracles and he's teaching in a way that no one else does. Right. Right. Good. Anybody else? Try to leave time when, I know a lot of times as a teacher, the thing is that once somebody says an answer, just to move on to the next one, I personally like to try to let more people contribute. Otherwise you get that one person or two who just always talk and the other people just kind of sit there. And it's good. A rule I learned from Chris Burbridge forever ago was count to seven. So I'll ask a question, and then in my head, I'm counting to seven to see how long it takes for somebody to fill the silence. And most of the time, somebody can't take it. Teenagers can, but it's kind of funny. Yeah.
I'm going to play non-believer here for a minute.
Yes.
Okay, so what are you going to do when the guy says, oh, that didn't really happen?
What part?
The whole story.
Oh.
It didn't really happen. There's no way that can happen, because miracles like that can't happen.
Right. Well, most likely that guy isn't coming to your group. Most likely. Now, if he is, yes, exactly. So then you do have to respond to that, and you don't want to just railroad him. I would continue asking questions back to him and ask him, you know, how do you know that?
Okay, so can we historically prove from history that Christ did miracles when he was here on earth?
No, you can't historically, scientifically prove any miracle.
No. Can you we can historically prove that Jesus Christ
existed
from history.
But you can't prove that George Washington.
Yeah, you can't prove historic events. You can't apply the scientific method to that. So that anytime you're talking about a historic event, you can't do that.
If you believe
we have good history for it, right?
Or you can believe that Jesus Christ died on a cross.
Right.
Historically.
Yeah.
Okay, so can we do that with miracles?
Of course. I think that's all part of the argument. Jim's wanting to jump in there. Go ahead, Jim.
I think the argument's bigger than that. I think that, well, people may want to go that way. What I would say is, you know, that it's bigger than that he said he did miracles. he's claiming to be God.
Right.
He's claiming to be the creator of the whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this question of did he heal this guy starts to become a non-issue. Are you going to actually believe that he is who he says he is or not? I think that's the way I would go with it. And even if they're not interested, I'd bear it out. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Jared?
Just on that note, I think I'd go in the direction, talking about historically, can you prove it? No, but what we can prove historically is the corroborating evidence of eyewitnesses.
Right.
You know, that if there was not eyewitnesses to these things, this would have been squashed long ago. You know, mm-hmm. going back to, you know, was he the Messiah or was he crazy or, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, the fact that it has stood the test of time and that they couldn't squash it, the Pharisees couldn't squash it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
I think that's the historical aspect.
Dan?
You could go on the apologetic end of saying, well, do you believe there was a Socrates?
Right.
Do you believe there was
right.
this? And then go to the historical record of how many copies of scripture we have, how old they are
mm-hmm.
compared to other things. So you could take it on in that direction. The other thing in the story we're reading, people are following Jesus because he did miracles. If he was a charlatan not doing miracles and none of this took place, there wouldn't have been these followings.
Yeah.
And so present the Bible itself as historical. Okay, this is how old it is. These were eyewitnesses that wrote it.
Yeah.
Josephus is a secular historian from that time, and he talks about Jesus being the worker of mighty, amazing things. So he's a secular historian out of that time, and Christianity Explored.
All the, form critics and others say that was added into Josephus. So you can get into that argument. That's the problem when we go that direction, is that whenever you try to go that direction, you start getting into kind of a combative thing that you're trying to avoid in that situation. At the same time, you don't want somebody taking over the group. So there is a way to shut it down without being cruel. But I think what Jim said is legitimate. I think what Jared said and Dan, I think all those angles and what Lois was saying, those are angles you can take, but that's not necessarily going to shut down a critic. They're not going to hear that. And so we have to be prepared on that level to expect, well, yeah, they might go there. So I would appeal to them. The purpose of this group, though, is to consider, at least for you, the possibility that could happen. Okay, so let's suspend that conversation for the moment.
I asked the question to get an answer myself. I asked the question.
Oh, I know.
To see what happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
It happened.
I know you're not doubting that, Mike. I'm not worried. Dave?
I think over all the years that I've witnessed to people, they're always going to come back with something.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have a setting in your home, they're probably not going to be coming at it anyway.
You know, yeah.
Really,
probably not, but maybe.
Unless they're really interested.
Yeah.
You know, I had a guy that I witnessed to for years at Fiat Alex on the midnight shift. Talked to him, like, look, I don't want to get into a debate. When you get into an argument type situation, you lost it.
Yeah, that. More or less.
And so just stick to God's word. You know, this is what I believe. I can't prove there's a God. Nobody can prove there's a God. But I know there's a God because he lives in my heart. And he saved me. That's where we need to go with people. Use your experience to go forth with a lot of this stuff.
And
you know, 3 years later, he came back to me. He says, I started going to Bible study. And I got saved. You know, these things may not happen now.
Yeah.
It may take a while for God. Once you
right.
plant the seed, but that's all we got to do.
Well, and what Mike's pointing out, though, is if you do have that guy or girl in the group, you have to be prepared to be able to shut that down or at least just move it on to the next thing. Because I've had a lot of oddball questions thrown at me at little group things like this before where you're like, what? Nope. I'm going to stay on the course and keep going. You know, otherwise you never get to the material, which is kind of what we're doing now. So
when you're inviting people, aren't you asking people who are really interested in finding the truth? That's what
I mean, that's who I think would come.
I'm not asking anybody to come. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if people are really interested.
You don't necessarily know that.
Yeah, you might not know that yet.
Well, my worldview on this is I'm going to go actually ask
just them. Power through them. Just power through them, Tim.
Okay. I hardly know at all.
Right, to answer the question or the objection that somebody like that would never show up.
Yeah.
You could invite somebody, they bring their brother, or they bring their uncle, whatever, who just is kind of interested and is actually coming, might be coming to be an antagonist. Now, whoever said it, you're probably right, they're probably not going to stick around, but it's very possible you could get somebody like that in a group like that.
I've been in a small group setting before where I've watched a guy brought up an objection like that, and he just goes, okay, and just moved on, and that was it. He just didn't entertain it and didn't let it go any further. Just like, okay, that's one possibility. What are the four men hoping Jesus would do? And just moved on. You don't have to engage in every question, and that's hard sometimes. But recognizing I'm trying to get this moving in a direction is important. So the second question there, what are the four men hoping Jesus would do? Well, this is kind of a rhetorical kind of question almost. There might be a better way to ask this, and you might give it some thought, but obviously they're expecting him to heal their friend. Third question here, what does Jesus do instead in Mark chapter 2, verse 5? Why do you think he does this, first of all? Why does he forgive him first and then heal him?
Shows who he is.
Okay.
May help us to understand what his purpose was in doing stuff.
Good.
That shows its authority, right? He has authority to forgive sin. I mean, if he says, I have authority to forgive sin, or I have authority to heal, they really go together, because if he can forgive sins, he can heal. If he really can forgive sin. That just shows who he really is in the first place.
Good.
I think he knew the room. He was in the room.
All right.
He knew those guys were there, and we're doubting his authority.
So he knows the room, going off what you're saying here, he knows the room, and these guys are going to challenge him on what he can do. So what should they know? What should the Pharisees know when Jesus does this? He should know that authentication comes after the witness, the prophecy, right? So you make the statement, and there's authentication after it. Jesus is going to challenge everything they know about who they think he is. He's already done different things, and now he's going to challenge, you think you know me, but let me mess with you a whole lot further. You know, and so this is a really kind of a fun question to get into with people here a little bit, if they really understand what he's saying, like Jim was saying. He's not just claiming to be Moses or some other Elijah. He's claiming something a lot higher than that, and I think that, again, we just saw the last time we were in this, how they were blown away that he could calm a storm. Now he does it again in a way that's even more like, whoa. That's a whole other level, right? So he's blowing their minds here a little bit all over again. Maybe a little bit's the wrong word to use there. There's a long response here. If you have the white book that explains this further, that is good. I think that's a good question, though, that people, I think, will really chat about a little bit. The fourth question, why were the teachers of the law so annoyed by what Jesus said? Good.
Yeah. Only God could forgive sins.
Yeah.
They couldn't answer what he just
did. Yep.
I mean, so their anger is really over the fact that he made a statement, a broad, bold statement.
Yeah.
And he backed it up with a miracle.
Right.
And they're like, okay, how do we answer that?
So now what?
Like,
right.
We say, I know you can't. I know you are. What am I? You know.
Yeah. Right.
They didn't have an answer.
Right. Exactly. So he's boxed them in, and they don't really know what to do. And they're not willing to entertain the idea that they could be wrong about who he is. They're not even willing to go there.
Well, the fact that he healed them in shows he has authority to forgive sin. That's
right.
That's why he says, difference does it make which one I say? Yeah.
So the next question here moves to, had they reached the right conclusion? Now, if you have the red book like Kurt's here, it's just as simple as that, isn't it, Kurt? Doesn't it just say?
Yep.
Yeah, had they reached the right conclusion? Now, my normal response to that is, what? What's your normal response to that? Did they reach the right conclusion, the Pharisees?
Yes.
Yeah. But what I like here in this book is that it gives you a good response to this. It's not just, it says yes and no. Okay? Yes, only God has the ultimate right and authority to forgive our sins, since all sin is an offense against God and all forgiveness must come from him. No, Jesus isn't blaspheming. So there, it's not just as simple as yes or no on that front. It's good. Again, it's a good question that somebody who's not educated in the word in particular is not going to think of it in those terms. They're going to be like, well, no, or yeah. They're just going to give you a flat thing like that. And while they have a whole lot of space there on that page to answer, they're probably just going to put yes or no. All right, so this is a good time for us as the leader, the teacher of this group, to get them to think more and actually, you know, this is where you're writing some notes, man. You know, some of those rhetorical questions might not have done that, but this one would.
Do you think that people will possibly raise the question of why did Jesus forgive the man's sins? In the sense of, it almost reads like Jesus looked at the faith of the others and forgave him.
Yeah.
So does that come up, or is that something to avoid here? Because it's...
I mean, it goes somewhat in a less antagonistic way back to what Mike was saying. Do you want to keep them moving, keep marching forward, or do you want to go into that? Because I think you can totally go into all of that and discuss all that. But like Lois is saying, who's already doing one of these groups, this, I mean, you could just talk about these things endlessly if you want.
There's also an implication in this text that the man's paralyzed because of his sins.
Right.
And that might be a question.
Yeah. That's good, Doug. Very good.
I got hung up on the story as a young believer because I thought it was more of like an allegory because I didn't understand why they would have to take a roof off. I remember it.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to Emily and she was like, what? I didn't get the structure of their homes.
Yeah.
And
that's good, Jim.
Taking off a roof, you know, it's like, well, how would they do that?
Well, Jim, I love that you highlighted that because you said as a young believer, that's where your brain was because this is the past and the people there are different. Right? It's a different time, different place. Their world isn't like ours. So that might be something that you don't want to skim past too fast and assume they know. Right? That like, isn't that weird? Why would they take the roof off? Because that is totally weird. You know, when you tell your kids this story, you've probably seen that face. Like, well, they cut a hole in the roof. You're like, what? Dad gets mad if I even chip the drywall. You know, let alone cut a hole in the roof. In the world are we thinking? Yeah, Dave?
Said to get just a book on Mark.
Yeah.
And to me, that's saying stay in Mark.
Yeah.
You and I and most of us in this room, we know far more.
Sure, yeah.
We know the other gospels explain a lot more detail.
Right.
So you can almost find yourself wanting to get out of Mark and go, let's go here.
Yep.
This is what he says about this.
Yep.
To explain it a little more in detail. And I don't know if that's going to be good or bad.
I think you can get into all kinds of different avenues, like you're saying. I think it is good if you can stay in Mark. That's ideal for this kind of a study, a very targeted effort.
Because Mark doesn't really go in.
Right. No, he's very abbreviated.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for sure.
It's going to be hard.
I agree.
A lot of this is like kind of, again, knowing the room, right? Knowing who your audience is. Because you have somebody that's never heard most of this. The conversation's going to be a little different than somebody that maybe grew up in the church that's left.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be a lot different.
I think it'd be a lot easier with a blank slate than somebody who's got some bad theology they've rolled through the years, and now they're bringing it into the room, you know?
Right now, we're basically going to do it in a small group who are Christians, unless we invite somebody that's not.
Yeah.
So, it's just kind of hard when you're talking to mature spiritual Christians, you know, and try to because you're trying to get every one of them minded into this, you know, witness to people.
Yeah.
That's basically what we're trying to do. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
So it's a hard thing to do. You know, I can remember years ago, if you will, just, you know, back in my days, it was...
It's still your day, Dave. You're not gone.
I had a book that came out called Drawing the Net.
Okay.
And I noticed in that white book, too, where it's at the beginning of it, it gives you an idea. When you give your testimony, which you're going to do sometime, most times you're going to give a testimony.
Yeah, sure.
That you had to be very particular on what you said. It's almost like, you know, that Drawing the Net was like you were an insurance salesman.
Mm-hmm.
You had to memorize.
Where this doesn't have that approach.
No, but he kind of led to that in the first part of that book. So come up with something that's going to catch their attention, you know, not just say, well, the Lord saved me and I, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So you're going to have to come up with something substantial that you're going to, like the first sentence you say is going to get the person's attention.
The hook. Yeah.
So, you know, I go back into days of the Roman world.
Yeah.
You know, I got a Bible that's still marked that way, that I used to have a little box, pocket Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Took it with me.
It's a good idea.
Always went through the Roman.
Sure.
You know, never did anything quite like this other than once you get the person saved.
This is more like what New Tribes does. Uh-huh. In that effort where New Tribes goes in and they start teaching them about Genesis, and they teach them about the law, and they teach them about the cross. So they have a very specific effort. They're not trying to get through the whole Bible. They're trying to hit these, who God is, you're a sinner, need for redemption, and Jesus is that one. And this is trying to keep us more on that line, I think. You know, I mean, that's the effort.
Yeah. It just took you from Genesis on up
to the
cross.
Yeah. We're just trying to, it's just evangelism training in a different category than is sometimes thought of,
Yeah. You
know, and not everybody's going to take to it exactly, but hopefully we are able to do well.
Yeah, Brian, back 50-some years ago when I was a skeptic, and in a college history class with a bunch of skeptics, with a skeptic for a professor,
yeah,
we got into a discussion in that class, a bunch of skeptics got into a discussion. The history professor said,
they call those haters now, by the way. Right, but yeah.
Of all the books in the New Testament, the most easy to maybe believe is the book of Mark, because it reads like a newspaper reporter back in the old days. Not today.
Interesting. Yeah. Today, no, right.
But back in the old days, because it just, here's the facts.
Yeah.
This is what happened.
Right.
And based upon that, I'm just relating back to that because it was...
Dragnet.
Yeah, it was...
Just the facts.
What? In other words, Matthew, Luke, and John, and the rest of them had a lot of this stuff in there that, you know...
Yeah.
You couldn't believe, but, I mean, this is just like a reporter wrote this.
This is more direct, more to the point. Yeah, on that front.
Yeah.
Good. That's a good point. Okay, so, obviously, there's a lot of trails you can go down here. And if you notice my announcement this morning, I don't know if everybody heard it or not, but we're going to, in October, we're going to do 2 weeks, and then we're going to evaluate to see if we want to. So we normally, of course, meet once a month. We're going to try meeting twice in October. We're going to see how the groups are able to handle that, if it's, easily sustained or whatnot, and then we'll reevaluate from there. Yeah.
The Jacksonville Bible study.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys are on your own trail, right?
Yep.
Right on. Okay, I wanted to show this video. It's a funny one with him. Did any of you watch it yet? No? Okay. Let's try to watch it real quick, Tev. Oh, light. Yeah.
Rugby.
Might have to have you shut it off. A minute. Anyway.
When I started college in 1991, I joined a rugby club. It was quite competitive, so I was sent a strict summer training schedule, which I immediately put in the bin. Anyway, September rolled around, and I arrived for club testing and training, feeling fairly confident. But when I got there, all the guys were very quiet, which was unusual. Then suddenly the coach came in and said, "Right, we'll start with a bleep test." The bleep test is a test where you run back and forth over 20 yards in time with a bleep that gets faster and faster. You run until you drop. In my case, that was not long in coming. I was the second to drop out, having collapsed and being physically sick. Next, we have to strip down to our shorts for the so-called fat test. Why not leave this part of the story to the imagination? Basically, a fat test is when your fat content is measured by this contraption that pinches the flesh all over your body. As it turned out, there was actually one other person who had an even higher percentage of body fat than me. We became firm friends. The results of all these tests were recorded and publicly announced, and it was extremely humiliating. Eventually, when all the tests had been completed, the coach got us all together and said, "Well, it's not comfortable, but at least we found out the truth on the training ground before the real questions get asked during a proper game." Sometimes we experience things in life that give us a shocking dose of reality, things that expose us in an extremely uncomfortable way. But as our coach said, it's better to find out the truth about ourselves while we still have time to do something about it. We've already explored who Jesus is. The question now is, why did Jesus come? Did he want to bring peace on earth? Was it to heal disease and end the sufferings of the world? Did he want to transform society and give us an example of how we ought to live? According to Mark, although there's an element of truth in all those options, they're not the main reason Jesus came. When we look at the world, there's so much to marvel at. But who can honestly say the world is all good? But histories of the 20th century suggest that at least 100 million people died violently in those 100 years. That is 2,400 violent deaths every day. The question is, why is the world like this? Jesus tells us the uncomfortable truth in Mark's gospel. He insists that the reason there's something wrong with the world is because there's something wrong with us.
Yeah, this is pointed.
Imagine for a moment a huge public gallery. On display for the whole world to see is the story of your life. It's a complete and truthful account, not only of everything you've ever said and done, but also of every thought that has ever crossed your mind. Nothing is edited out. Everything is here for everyone to look at. Now, I'm sure there'd be lots that you'd be relatively proud of. Loving relationships, real achievements, acts of kindness, moments of generosity, perhaps a flourishing career. But there would also be thousands of things you'd want to keep out of the public eye. Which bit of the wall would you most want to cover up? Maybe it's something nobody knows, not even your closest friend. And it's not just the things we've said, done, and thought that are a problem. There are the things we should have done, and the words we should have said. If my life were on those walls, it would be a nightmare. I hate my life to be on display for everyone to see. I'd be so ashamed. I wouldn't be able to look people in the eye. Could you, if you're being honest? So what is the problem? Why is there so much to be ashamed of? Jesus gives us the answer in Mark chapter 7. What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. So when we look at the world and see all the things that are wrong with it, we instinctively want to point the finger at others. But Jesus says the problem is much closer to home. The reason the world is not the way it's supposed to be is because we're not the way we're supposed to be. And if we were to trace all the evil in the world back to its source, says Jesus, the place we'd end up is the human heart. For the people of Jesus' day, the heart was not simply the pump that sends blood around the body. It was thought of as the seat of human personality. It was the real you. Why is it so hard to keep good relationships going? Why do we hurt those we love most? Why can't we automatically do what we know is the right thing? And why are we so often tempted to do what we know is wrong? Because each of us has a heart problem. Unfortunately, according to Jesus, our problems don't end there. It's not just that we often treat each other and our world in a shameful way. We treat God in that way too. In Mark chapter 12, Jesus tells us how we should relate to God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. Jesus calls this the most important commandment, and with good reason. Because God made us and sustains us and gives us every good thing we enjoy, what should be our response to him? Jesus tells us we should love God with all our heart, soul, mind and strength. And the really scary word here is all. It means that no part of our lives is to be withheld from God. He is to have all of everything. But that's not our heartbeat. We decide exactly what we'll do with our heart, soul, mind and strength. We give our hearts to lots of things, but not to our Creator. We barely know his commands, let alone seek to obey them. We develop relationships with others, but neglect the very relationship for which we were primarily designed. And instead of loving God, we live as if we were God. And that's what the Bible calls sin. So why did Jesus come? According to Mark's Gospel, Jesus came to cure our heart problem, the problem of our sin. Here's what happens in Mark chapter 2, verses 15 to 17. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Notice how uptight these people are with Jesus. They're called the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, and they were the religious establishment. They were always at the synagogue, always praying, always trying to do the right thing. And they are furious here because Jesus is spending time with all the people they love to look down on, especially tax collectors, who were hated because they worked for the occupying Roman forces. But the shock for us, as it was for many religious people at the time, is Jesus' statement in verse 17. It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. You see, Jesus knows that when we look at our world and the state of our hearts, no one can seriously claim to be righteous. No one has managed to love God with all their heart, all their soul, all their mind, and all their strength. If we were able to live like that, there'd be no reason for him to have come at all. No, says Jesus, I haven't come to call people who think they're good, who think they've nothing to be ashamed of. I've come for people who can see what's going on in their own hearts, people who realise they're desperately in need of a cure. If that's you, then I hope you can begin to see why Mark describes Jesus as good news. The qualification for coming to Jesus is not, are you good enough? It's, are you bad enough? He's come for people who realise they're bad, not for people who think they're good. That's the real reason Jesus came. And isn't it ironic that these religious people, who think that their hearts are perfectly acceptable to God, are the very ones who end up plotting to kill Jesus? So Jesus says, I've not come to call the righteous but sinners. But why did Jesus feel the need to call sinners at all? For the answer to that question, we need to look at the most disturbing verses in Mark's Gospel, chapter 9, verses 43 to 48. It's here that Jesus tells us just how serious our heart problem really is. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands, to go into hell where the fire never goes out. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than to have 2 feet and be thrown into hell. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have 2 eyes and be thrown into hell, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. I was in Australia visiting a friend, and he took me to a beach on Botany Bay. So I decided I had to go for a swim. I was just taking off my shirt when he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going for a swim." He said, "What about those signs?" I said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous. I'll be fine." He said, listen, mate, 200 Australians have been killed by sharks. You've got to decide whether those signs are there to save you or to ruin your fun. You're of age, you decide. And with that, he walked off down the beach. When we hear Jesus' words about hell, we have to ask ourselves, why would he talk like this? Is he trying to manipulate us? Trying to scare us just so he can gain control of us? Or is he giving us a loving warning? For me, as I look at Jesus' life and the way he treated people, I see the most loving man who ever lived. Even people who were rejected by the rest of the world were deeply loved by him. The reason Jesus warns us about hell is surely because he loves us and does not want us to go there. He knows that if we reject God throughout our lives, then ultimately God will be right to reject us. He knows that our sin, if left undealt with, will take us to a place of unimaginable and unending suffering. He warns us because he loves us. But here's the problem. Jesus is not giving us the cure for our sin when he talks about cutting off a hand or a foot or gouging out an eye. Even if we were to do that, the knife would never go deep enough. It would never get to the heart of the human problem, which is the problem of the human heart. The urgent reality is that our hearts are desperately in need of a cure. And no matter what we do, as history has shown, we cannot cure it ourselves. But that is why Jesus came. As much as I hated the fat test and the bleep test, it was far better for me to be exposed as unfit on the training ground than in front of spectators in a crucial game. In the same way, Jesus exposes what we're really like so that we can respond to him while there's still time. We'll never understand why Jesus came until we see the reality of our own hearts. And if we don't see that, we'll go through life without noticing that actually we are in terrible danger.
All right, so there's many questions you can spring to from this, I believe. There are questions that are supplied here as well. Hopefully, like I said, you're able to make the most of that and roll with your group in going through the discussion on this. We're out of time, so, Davis, you want to turn that off at all? Thank you, sir. All right, you are dismissed.